Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and rumradio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe, which is either expanding or declining depending on what side of the planet you're on. I would like to acknowledge WNAH, Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama as a public service presentation. Would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals that affords us some print space from time to time. I'd gratefully like to introduce my co-host, but Harold's not with us, but we have a special guest tonight, Dan Farish, who wrote a book, and it's going to be a real interesting show. I think if you're listening or if you're going to the archive, this is going to be worth your time. I believe that the family, Harold's a family intervention specialist, and I believe the family is the core of our society. And as the family goes, so does the nation. Before I get started, I like to get into the third step prayer. Now, this isn't AA. You know, a lot of people like to make a disclaimer. This is Rum Radio. I use the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous because that is the original template of 12-step recovery. And I'm kind of a guy that thinks this way. If you copy something from original, it's never really quite the same. So I think the big book is really a lot of really good information, and it has the 12 steps as suggested recovery. And on page 63 of that basic text, there's a thing called the third step prayer. When I get a newcomer, a new sponsee, the way I find them, usually I go out and get them. And on page, I believe it's 89 in chapter 7, Working with Others, it tells us real specific, go find the prospect and work on them. It doesn't say have the prospect find you, although that's what we do, and sometimes that really works well. But that's not the direct instruction. So I'll circle up in a meeting. We usually have a closing prayer at the end, and I'll find the new fellow who just got his beginner's chip. They're hot. They're ready to go. They've made the decision that they have a problem, and now they're looking for a solution. So I go around the circle. I grab hands with them. We usually hold hands in most clubs, say our Father or a different prayer, but a form of benediction, thanking God, your higher power, for the time that we had to spend together in recovery. And after the prayer, I turn around to them and I'll go, have you had enough? Yes or no? If he's had enough, he won't ask what that means. Sometimes they'll do, have you had enough pain? Have you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough? Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. You can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And I'll carry around a list, Clancy's 7 questions. And on the list, it's like a little mini fourth step. And I'll say, the first thing I need you to do is answer these 7 questions, and I need them back tomorrow. Here's my number. I expect your call. And that's it. I'm done. If I get it back tomorrow, he's taken simple instruction, and he's ready to go. If I don't get it back, it's not like I'm going to get it back in a couple of days because his dog ate his homework. I don't hear from him. Or if I see him in a meeting, he kind of walks around me. You know, he wasn't ready. And that's okay. That means he either wasn't ready or wasn't ready for me. And so now he's back, and then one of the first assignments I give him is, and it's, I believe, men with men, women on women, when possible. If that's not possible, we work the steps. But usually, gender proper works out to be the best way to go. So it's a very intimate interaction between two people. And the first thing I give them, I ask them to get a newcomer's packet or a list of men that are going to be in his home group. So he's going to have to find a home group. These are the people that this is your lifeline, folks. And the men will write their numbers, their name and number, and give them permission to call. I suggest they get that. And then when they have those numbers right away, I want you to call a different fella every day and recite the third step prayer. And the third step prayer is, I consider that the surrender prayer. And the reason I have them do that is to get used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Two, they're going to connect up with their fellowship. People are going to get to know their name. They're going to get to know their name. This is a lifeline group. Third, it's going to encapsulate what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, possibly the fellow he's calling might have been thinking about picking up his first drink of alcohol. And when he makes that call, chances are, no guarantee, he won't do that. So that's the first assignment. Now, this is the prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that? Amen. I'd like to introduce our honored interviewee, Dan Farish. You there, Dan?
I'm here. Thanks, Joseph. It's a pleasure to be on the show.
Yeah. Well, you've written a book now. I know you're life coach? Not a life coach. You're a spiritual counselor and a recovery coach now.
Yes, addiction recovery coaching.
And you've written a book. It's very good. I've read it. Dan sent it to me, PDF file, so I got it on the computer. But actually, I'll tell you, I would have purchased the book myself. And for me to say that is pretty drastic. I throw nickels around like manhole covers. It's called Three Steps to Recovery, One Man's Triumph Over Alcohol and Drugs. Approach to overcoming any addiction. I'll start with this, and then I'm going to be quiet for a while and let Dan tell you some of his story so we can get into that. Page 164 in the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it says, this book is only meant to be suggestive. We know so very little. More shall be disclosed to both you and to us. It also says, it's another page, I don't know what page it is. Be quick to see where religious people are right or wrong or someone else. So what the book is, it's a statement, these are statements of humility. We don't know it all. We need to know it all. All we need to know what works for us and how to be of maximum service to God and our fellows. So, Dad, tell us about your childhood. I was reading that. Your dad sounded a lot like my dad.
Yeah, my father was an interesting character. He was an angry man. He didn't drink, but was perpetually angry. He was a bit of a brute, putting it mildly. And basically, he made life difficult for his family. And we were young kids, and you'd come home and see things 4 years old, find your mother pinned on the kitchen floor later that same year, walked into the house and she had her head in the oven, she had the gas on, she was going to end it all. And this was just beatings. My older sister took a lot of beatings, and it was a lot for a young kid the age of four to absorb. But it was, that was life in our home. And there was no alcohol or drugs involved. He was just an angry man that had some problems and pretty much spent his whole life like that.
Mm. I understand there was a saying I came across. You know, when I do the website, I like to put little phrases and sayings, so I've been able to accumulate them like lint. And one of them was very interesting, and it fits into recovery, is that anger could be as heady as alcohol or heady as whiskey once you've grown a taste for it.
Yeah, so I think that anger, addiction, anxiety, and a lot of other issues that people have, of course, they're fear-based, but these are symptoms of deeper issues. And to me, that's the true spiritual dis-ease, hyphenated. Not so much the disease mode, but these are the things, and you find out that the drinking or the anger or gambling, whatever it is normally a symptom of the real issue, you know, and which are fear-based. But these issues are mostly come from trauma. His father was abusive to him as a child, and he was never able to rise above it. He carried that within him, and he passed it along to his own kids as well. And it wasn't much. He couldn't reason with them. He couldn't do much with them.
Yeah, I remember in the book you said you can't really reason with a hillbilly, although you have a chance with a redneck.
Well, I lived in East Tennessee in the mountains, and with the hillbillies, a lot of them go to church, drink strychnine out of a jar, and wrap rattlesnakes around their necks during church services as part of the ceremony.
Is that like a fashion statement up there?
Well, it's a test of your faith, and it comes from a one-line biblical quote that says, "Fear not, the serpent's poison." So, but, you know, a redneck may be a redneck, but you can normally use logic to reason with them, and they understand you pretty well. Excuse me, I've got a bit of a cold. But it's very difficult with the hillbillies. it's a different thing altogether.
I understand. They're very close family oriented, aren't they?
Yeah, there was one old lady, I used to make a game out of it. We'd moved there from Boston, so we stuck out like a sore thumb anyhow. And we bought 60 acres in a place called Clinch Mountain over in Clinch Valley. And I would drive by every day on the way to work, and the old lady would be sitting on her front porch. She must have been about 75. And I waved to her, and she never would. She never waved back. So after a while, it became a game, and I'd just smile at her and wave every time I went by. And this went on for a couple of years, and she never did once crack the smile or raised her hand. You're a foreigner, and that's it. They don't know you. They don't want to talk to you. So it was an interesting time out there.
I've heard it's like a different world out there. It's like time stood still out in the hills like that. They just have their own little cloister of understanding, and everyone's an outsider unless you've been there for three or four generations or something.
Yeah,
It's like that a little bit in Vermont too, but at a higher intellectual level.
You can find pockets anywhere. Maine, I guess, but you know. Up that way too. I think there's rednecks in the north as well as the south. It just depends on where you're at and your state of mind, really, your attitude towards things.
So tell me about your sister.
My older sister, she was great. She's 10 years older than me. So when a lot of these things were going on, she was sort of like very much like my second mother. And she took me under her wing from a young age, basically from the time I was brought home from the hospital. She adopted me as hers, and I was like a new doll to her, I think. So she would do things like, she bought me my first bicycle, my first puppy, and she took a job just waiting tables so she could do that.
And, wow.
You know, she stood up against my father quite a bit. She was quite a defiant teenager herself. And that it didn't work in her favor, but she never did back down from him. And she took a lot of abuse as a result. But she was great. She was, you know, my pillar of support right up until her 18th birthday when I was 8 years old. And then she moved out the day of her birthday because she was legal age to do that then. And that's when things really changed, you know, in the household. It was never quite the same. But she's doing all right. She struggled all her life, and you know, I wish that she could could learn to let go, but it's been difficult for her. So she's quite normal. She's never turned to alcohol or drugs in that sense, but she has a lot of bitterness and anger within her that she doesn't know how to release, and it just made it a difficult life for her as well. And then my younger sister, Linda, was the youngest of the family. She was the baby of the family. And she became an alcoholic later, and she died at 42 years old, which was about 8 years ago, I guess. Yeah, so...
And your mom sounded like more like the perpetual victim.
I think she was adept at pushing my father's buttons without even meaning to. I'm not sure that she intended to do that, but they were what they would call today a codependent couple, I think. They sort of fed off of each other's issues, and she spent a lot of time defending my father's behavior and denying, deeply in denial about it. During my heyday of drinking, I carried it all. You know, it was always in the back of my mind, and drinking would bring it out even more. And I'd get on the phone, at 8 o'clock or 10 o'clock at night, and give them a call, and want to talk about some of these things that happened, because this was the issues that were driving my addiction. I was drinking to escape it, the memories of it. But I wasn't able to really do that. And it worked in the early days, but then later, of course, it amplifies those issues. So I called them and asked them about it. I said, hey, do you remember the time this happened? What about that? No, none of these things ever happened, according to her. I don't know what you're talking about. Your father was never like that. And besides, he was abused by his father, too. So there was always an excuse for it as well. But she didn't say two. She just said his father was mean to him, But at the same time, denying that anything had ever happened in the family. So there was a lot of anger, deep anger, frustration more than anything. Why they chose to treat the kids the way they did. They basically disowned all three of us. They wanted us out of the house. My father would always say, when you're 18, you can get out. Until then, you'll do what I tell you to do. And everybody wanted to pretty much get out around the age of 18. So I went into the Navy, and my sister moved out on her birthday. So there was no accountability, ever, throughout their lifetimes. So we had to learn how to, or the best we could, how to adapt to that. As I say, my younger sister drank herself to death. My older sister just carried the anger. It's affected all our relationships. She's an unhappy person. She's a good person, but she's not happy and because of these issues. And so I was somewhere in the middle. I was angry, and I was drunk, too, most of the time. And eventually had to – around 38, I hit bottom. Everything fell apart in my life. I realized that if I didn't make a change, that jail or death were the only two options, which I'm sure a lot of addicts or former addicts can identify with. So that was the time I decided something had to be done.
You started drinking fairly early. I've heard stories. I was an alcoholic in the womb, and the next guy says, "Well, I was an alcoholic before that too." So when did you first notice that alcohol was going to do it for you?
14 was the magic number for me. But the other thing my father did was he tended to antagonize the neighborhood kids. We lived in a working-class Boston suburb, a short distance outside of the city, and there were some tough kids in the neighborhood, and he would call the police on them if he saw them riding a mini bike down the street or something like that, some minor things. Stop his car, get out and scream at them if he saw them skateboarding down the road. It didn't matter. If anybody came to the door, they usually weren't welcome, and he was just as often as not would tell them to get the hell off his front steps. Led to a lot of animosity on their part, the kids, and I I took the brunt of it pretty much because of my father. So there was a lot of that going on. But anyways, at around 14, I found myself running home quite a bit. I had been beaten up, caught and beaten up by, you know, as many as 8 or 9 kids at once. And my parents went out on a Saturday night, which they rarely did, but they were going to a wedding and they weren't going to be home till late. They had a bottle of rum in the cupboard. And I had been playing this. I'm like, well, you know what? I'm going to go ahead and get myself a taste of that, I think. And so I did, and it was magic. You know, it just did the trick. I was at home, completely relaxed, comfortable, threw on my jacket, went down to the ringleader, the neighborhood bullies. He was like the alpha male, this guy. Knocked on his front door and told him, I said, if you want to have a fight, let's do it right now. And that got me major acceptance. He just welcomed me into his house. I was in the club after that. He realized I'd been drinking. He thought it was fantastic. And so then I was in the club. You know, and alcohol and drugs became pretty much an every weekend event. And sometimes during summer vacations, we'd sleep out in tents in the backyard and have beer or whatever stashed out in the woods and go spend the night out there. And that just took off from there. And then when I joined the Navy, that really elevated things because that's what you do, you know. At the end of the day, you get together with your sailor buddies and go drinking. And it's a quite a game for the older sailors when they get a young kid, about 18 years old, and they say, "Oh, come on, we're gonna show you how to drink." So you want to keep up with them, and I was pretty good at it. So things just took off from there, and it became a 20-year thing.
Yeah, it's just once you got started. And I remember, digress a little bit with your mom. I remember in the book it said. She put a plastic bag over her head, and she was laying in bed. And it seemed the timing was good because there was still a lot of humidity inside the bag. So she hadn't been in the bag that long. She was feigning suicide?
She was timing it for attention. It was sort of like her head in the oven. She wasn't actually going to gas herself, but it was theatrical. And when you're 4 years old, I mean, that really terrorizes you, scares you to death. By the time she was putting the bag over her head, she knew that we were smoking pot or, you know, doing things that we shouldn't be doing. And things weren't going well with my father and her at the time. And she was at the point, she was in her mid-40s, I guess, by that time. And she was depressed, absolutely. Pretty despondent, not mentally ill. She was quite lucid, but she was looking for attention. So I'd come home from school when I was 14, 15 years old, and walk down the hall, and she would always leave her bedroom door open. It was a small house. You had to walk past the room to go to the bathroom. And just as you do, you wonder where your mother is when you come home, and she'd be laying on the bed, and she'd have a dry cleaning bag over her head.
Mm.
It wasn't even steamed up yet, you know. It was just put on, you know, and she was always going to leave, too. That was the other thing, whenever there was a problem. If she had a fight with my father or whatever, and I'm leaving, that's it, you'll never see me again. And she'd put on her coat and grab her purse and start heading for the door. And when we were young kids, you know, 8, 9, 10, that would also upset us greatly, and we'd beg her not to go. Please don't go. And then she'd stop and reconsider. And so we were used as pawns until about the age of 16, I think, when she pulled that routine for the last time with me. She did the same. She put on her coat and her grabbed her purse, and that was it. We were never going to see her again. Started heading for the door, and I said, "Okay, see ya."
gone.
And my father's like, "Well, your mother's leaving. What are you going to do about it?" I said, "Nothing. If she wants to go, let her go."
Let it go.
No, I don't blame her. They were both stunned, the two of them. Their jaws dropped, and they just stared. And they realized that the game wasn't working anymore, and that was the last time that ever happened.
That was the end of the game. Yeah. So now the Navy, that didn't really work out for you too well either.
By that time, I'm 18 years old. I went into the Navy because I had my license revoked indefinitely. I smashed my father's car into a parked car. Drugs were found in the car, and my license was revoked indefinitely, not suspended, gone for a minimum of 1 year. My parents talked, well, my mother, my father didn't get involved in it because he was too angry, but my mother spoke with a lawyer. Lawyer thought it would be a good idea. We'd get more favorable treatment from the judge if I told him that I was joining the Navy. Or military. So I went in, but by the time I was 18, this is the age now when I'm just, you know, it's kind of like Alice Cooper sings, I'm 18 and I like it. You're at that point where you're a boy and just thinking you're a man or starting to think you are. And in all these years, and I was out of the house finally, and it's like, you know, I've got a whole lifetime of pent-up anger here, and I'm not going to take orders from anybody anymore. I've had enough. So I wasn't really a great sailor. I went in, I was there, I kept my mouth shut for the most part, but they didn't like my attitude. You know, I just wasn't gung-ho enough, which just made my attitude worse. I'd taken enough orders. They didn't know that if they said, well, you know, if you keep this up, you better salute me and that sort of thing. And, of course, I did salute real officers, but the petty officers, they wanted me to, but I wouldn't do it, you know. So I went through the motions. I went to school to become an electrician's mate, and that got me off on the wrong foot because I was drinking. I was struggling with the classes. I was having a problem with the concept of it. But then again, I was also going out every night drinking, so I wasn't doing my studying, and I was in the course. They put me through an advanced course, actually, accelerated course, because they said that my grades, you know, my aptitude testing was good. So they put me on basically on twice the speed. But I never have been a fast learner. I've just been I always needed time to absorb information. It went too quickly for me, and I just threw my hands up in the air. After a while, my instructor didn't want to hear it. He didn't care. You either got the grades or you didn't. And if you didn't, then it was going in your report. So I was shipped out from boot camp with a report saying that I had an attitude problem. First time I stepped on a ship, I had these petty officers, two or three of them approached me and said, we hear you have a bad attitude. Okay, and if you pull any kind of crap around here, you're going to know about it. Well, that was just like saying, go ahead. You know, you're making my day here, too, because you already got a strike against you from the beginning. So there was nothing, and I really didn't want to be there. I wanted to be back home with my friends doing my old thing, you know, which I pretty much successfully did in the end. It was a reserve plan, so I had to do 8 months active duty, but the rest of it was weekend reserve time. And that was cutting into my party time too much. But by the time I'm 19 years old, I'm like, you know, I don't want to go to these things anymore. So I just walked in one Sunday morning. I was supposed to be there Saturday, but I showed up a day late and told my lieutenant that I was quitting. He said, you can't quit the Navy. I said, well, yes, I can. No. He says, you can't. I said, well, I can, and I am, right now. So you can lock me up for 45 days. They can come and get me if they want to. You know, I'll do the 45 days, and I know that they have to let me go after that. And he couldn't. He was just a super nice guy. Lieutenant Bresnahan was his name. And he says, well, I'll recommend you for a general discharge, but I can't promise you anything. I'm like, fair enough. But, you know, shook his hand and walked out, and that was the last time I ever heard from him. And that was in 1974, you know, so.
Did you get the discharge?
You, you, No, I never got anything.
Nothing.
I never got never heard a word.
You know, it's funny. When I saw your picture on the face cover, I said, you know, I've seen this guy somewhere before. I think there's a picture of you up in the post office.
If you ever see me on America's Most Wanted, it looks like me. It's not me, all right?
Sure. Yeah, that's what they all say.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Officer,
so that was
everybody
the sort of
has
attitude. I'm sorry, go ahead.
You know, officer, that's not really me. You know, they say everyone has somebody that looks exactly like him. That's the other guy.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I don't have any brothers, so I can't give their name. You know, it was just me. But that was just the attitude I had by that time. And it was, you know, the most self-destructive attitude you could have, I suppose. You know, I'll fix you, I'll hurt me, I don't care, bring it on. You know, you wanted to prove yourself. And so I spent quite a bit of time doing that, you know. And it was just, and of course, it's going to come back and bite you what goes around comes around, which it eventually did.
And then you had hard times keeping a regular job. You didn't really play well in the kindergarten.
Authority, you know, I had a job, you know, assembly line job, and I was boxing up range hoods, kitchen range, vent hoods, and all I wanted was my radio. And if I could have my radio blast, then I was good, you know, and they would come around and say, turn your radio down. And I would until they went around the corner and I turned back up again. And, you know, and I received several warnings. If you don't turn that radio down, we're going to take it away. You won't have one. I'm like, yeah, whatever. Go around the corner, turn it back up again. So they took my radio away, and I quit. That was it. I just walked out the door.
I had a similar situation, actually. I worked at the post office for a while, and they had this kid that was a temporary supervisor, and he had no business. He couldn't run his own life, but they had these petty tyrants. And I had earphones on, and he said, no, I don't want you to have any earphones. And, you know, that always caused a problem. You know, the authority. I always seem to run into petty tyrants until I realized that I was a petty person myself. See, they weren't
That's
really
right.
petty. I was petty. But it was always easier to blame them as being the tyrant.
Absolutely. They represented authority. They wanted you to do the right thing, and who were they to tell you what to do? You know?
Amen.
I had that king baby syndrome, I was told, and I didn't really know what that was, but it's just what it sounds like. You're a big baby, and you're the king of the babies. You know, so you become a tyrant. You tell people how it's going to be. You know, you make the rules for everybody else, but you don't have to follow them yourself because you're the king. And of course, if you get your hand slapped, then you're kind of a baby about it, and you throw a tantrum. You know, so that describes an awful lot of alcoholics and addicts, I think.
I want to give the guest call-in number in case somebody would like to call in question. Very rarely that happens. Most of our hits come from the archives. In case someone wants to chime in, ask Dan a question, or they want to contribute to the conversation, the number is 949-534-0621. And in New Jersey, it's 949-534-0621. In Alabama, you get the hint. So you got these meaningless jobs and never seems to work out. You're always in between jobs, or you got a job that really doesn't matter whether you come or you go. And eventually you meet a young lady and want to make a home.
Absolutely. And she was a really nice girl. We met in a bar, of course, at a club. Her sisters hated me instantly, but they thought I was cocky and arrogant, and so I asked if I could join them. It was her and three of her sisters, and I asked if I could have a seat, and they said, and three of them just said, no, and I pulled up a chair and sat down anyhow, because I could, because I was the king baby, and... she loved it. Her sisters couldn't stand the sight of me, but she was very attracted to that. She thought I was just the James
how
Dean
bold.
Type, I guess. How old?
No, I say how bold. Women like
yes.
women like bold.
Yes.
Fate favors the bold.
Yeah, exactly. You know, so we hit it off, and we were married for 19 years. We and had two children together, two boys, and had a. She's a great person now. She was at the time. I still did whatever I wanted to do. She was married. I wasn't, pretty much. And the party scene was it. I mean, I was going out to bars every night that I could afford to, or drinking at home, and would go out till 2-3, whatever time the bars closed, come home. She'd get coffee in the morning, bring it to the bed, because it was the only way I could drag myself out of the bed to get up to go to work. And most days I made it, some days I didn't. You know, but she never once criticized my drinking. She never said anything about it. In all the 19 years we were together, never, you know, for one time I mentioned it.
So she wasn't really a drinking buddy. Was she an Al-Anon? Codependent?
She was codependent. We were, I went into, when I went into rehab, they do some counseling sessions just for the spouse and the inmate, as I called it, and sat down, and it was a woman psychologist, and she diagnosed us as like opposites, which I'd never heard before. We appeared to be opposites on the surface, but we're very much alike underneath. So she was a people pleaser. She had been kind of abused by her mother, not so much her father, but by her mother as a child. And she was a pleaser. So she had her own issues, and for whatever reason, she was attracted to someone like me. And probably because I did defy authority. And I think that secretly that's what she always wanted to do, but she was a true conformist. She's still in the same job now as she was when we met about 30 years ago. And you know, she's that type. Me, I changed, you know, 3-4 jobs a year at the time. It would be in and out of work. But she's always been very steady. She was a great mother for that reason. And my kids have done very well. Neither one of them have developed an addiction problem, which is great.
You know, that's interesting you should say that. I remember part in the book it said that she wasn't comfortable with you finally deciding to go to rehab, and I think you came to the point where it's not really quite the jumping off point, but pretty darn close, where you figure the alcohol is going to kill you if you don't address it.
It was my decision to go. When I hit my bottom, you know, it was pretty damn hard, really. I lost my business at a restaurant.
Oh, the pizza parlor, yeah.
Yeah, pizza and lost that. It was going to be repossessed. They were going to change the locks on the place. Mm-hmm. I've been drinking every day for the last, at least the last 6 weeks that I was there, serving people food. I was walking around with a styrofoam cup with beer in it all the time. I knew it was going down. It was a sinking ship. And I knew that there was no money to save it, and I just went for the ride. I said, "It's going down. You know, we can hope for the best, but this is it's not going to happen." And I didn't want to alarm my employees or anything, but of course, you know, walking around drunk doesn't help, and so your good employees tend to bail out on you, and so do a lot of your customers. So I went home after that. And it had an affair as well, and that had gone bad.
Norma. Was that Norma?
Norma, yeah, Norma. And my wife and her fiance, Norma's fiance, found out about us the same day, which was, that was the final day that the restaurant was ever open.
Wow.
So I spent
three punches for the same. Yeah.
Yeah. it was the last day of the business. I locked the doors. I had one very loyal employee left. He was my driver and helper. And he went down and got me beer. He came in and checked on me. I was there for 3 days. I didn't go home. I slept in my booth, my red booth of the restaurant. And he would pop in, see how I was doing, spend a little time with me. I'd send him down to the store to get me another case of beer. He'd come back with it, and then he'd leave. And so that's why I spent 3 days throwing up, not eating, just drinking and passing out. And then I finally dragged myself home, took a shower, and the couch became my new bedroom because my wife didn't, understandably did not want me in there with her. You know, so she'd go in and lock the door, and I was sitting there on the couch. I got no work to go to, no money to do anything with. And it was very icy in the house. You know, the tension was really bad. So I'd get up every day, say, okay, I'm going to quit drinking. I've had enough of this. And there was a little money left. I probably had $200 or whatever. And every day I'd get up and say, this is it. Today I'm quitting. And that would last until about 2 or 3 o'clock on a good day. And I'd be down at the liquor store and back up and drinking when they came home from school and work. The kids were young. And my wife would come home about 6 o'clock in the evening. And things weren't improving. You know, I was between a rock and a hard place. I knew it. I'd gone to another friend's house or apartment because we were living in an apartment complex and drank with him one night. And he went in to use the bathroom, and I was just standing in the kitchen waiting for him. I got a drink in my hand, and I looked towards the floor, and I just, for whatever reason, there was a premonition of my own ghost laying on the floor. I just saw my own outline of my body laying there, and I don't know if there was alcohol-induced or not, but it was enough to leave a lasting impression on me. And so I went back home, continued drinking every day, and on a Saturday night, drank another 12-pack or whatever, went to sleep. Woke up on a Sunday morning. The wife was still icy as could be. She didn't want any part of me. Was very hostile. And the idea occurred to me that, Jesus, she has a great insurance policy where she works. I wonder if it covers rehab. Because this would be like club med to me at this point. I just wanted someplace, another place to escape to, and it would have to be better than staying home, you know, in the environment I was in.
Sure.
With her. And so that was a part of my motivation for going in, but I also knew that I had to do something. This couldn't continue because the premonition I had was very strong. And, you know, I just knew things were not going to go well. So she got out I asked her for the insurance policy, if I could have a look at it. She was quite angry that I asked about it. She wanted to know why I wanted it. I told her why, because I was thinking about going into rehab. She thought that was a ridiculous idea, but she went and got it. She brought it up and she threw it at me when I was sitting on the couch. I looked at it. Sure enough, I was covered for 30 days. And sat there for another couple of hours, thought about it, and picked up the telephone and called a place locally. And about 3 hours later, we were there. There was a pint of tequila in the kitchen cupboard. There was no more beer left, but there was a pint of tequila, and I said, this is perfect. This is going to be my breakfast today because I'm going to get buzz on before I go in. And that's exactly what happened. Just as we turned in the parking lot, I had finished my last swallow of it and was feeling pretty good. And asked her to come inside with me, if she would, until we signed in. She got out, slammed the car door. She did not want to go in, but she came in. And as I was signing the papers, I turned around and asked her a question, and she was gone. So that was the beginning of rehab. That's how we started.
You know, it's kind of interesting that she was reluctant for you to go, it seems like it goes back to the man she married was very brash and bold and, you know, could start his own business and do all this stuff, and now he's acknowledging that he's a weak man.
Yes, exactly. There was a big part of it. Plus, all the pressure was going to be on her now. She was going to have to pay the rent because I wasn't working at this point. Not that I had been anyways. But she had to take care of the kids, find a babysitter. And these are all, you know, understandable things, you know, that I was sticking out on her. But she didn't, not being an alcoholic herself, I don't think she could fathom why somebody couldn't just put the bottle away and be done with it, especially somebody like me that was so brash and so confident. But she didn't realize that all that brashness and confidence came from alcohol. That it, you know, I used to be this introverted, shy kid, and alcohol turned me into Superman, you know. So she expected, and I never had any questions about anything. If I wanted to, you know, if I put my mind to do something, I did it. I'd always been able to do that pretty much, and got away with it. I made my first pizza 3 days before we opened the restaurant. I had never made one before,
but wow.
I knew how one should taste. And so we cooked pizzas, tried different sauce recipes, different types of cheeses, until it tasted like what I expected it should taste like.
Okay.
Once, you know, once we got there, that's how we went with it. But that's how, pretty much how we did everything.
I came across a saying, I think you'll like it. I put a lot of sayings, if you've been on the website, you know, to try to amplify some of our understandings. Alcohol removes inhibitions, like that
Absolutely.
Scared little mouse who got drunk and shook his whiskers and shouted, "Now bring on that damn cat."
That's it. Exactly. And that's what gave me the courage to go meet that neighborhood bully. Confront him face to face and get acceptance from him. So, you know, because he was the alpha male, the king of the bullies, he just put out the word to everybody else in the neighborhood, leave him alone, he's cool. You know, he's one of us now. And that was the end of my troubles. You know, so it was, this was great stuff. You know, I was talkative, I was funny, I was, you know, not my quiet self. Because when I was 14 years old, before I started drinking, if somebody looked at me, I would take it the wrong way. If I thought they would give me a dirty look, I'd feel sick to my stomach. That's how introverted I was at the time. And this was the magic cure. It really was.
People in the outside of the program who don't have an issue with this, it's hard for them to comprehend that. Most people say if they're drinking after one or two drinks and say, "I have to stop, I'm starting to feel it." And, you know, like,
yes.
What do you mean by that? That's why we drink. Get it?
That's the point of the exercise.
I'm starting to feel it. Stop.
You know,
do you mind if I do it for you? Yeah.
I never drank just because I loved the taste of it so much. I eventually learned to really love the taste, you know, but not at first. I was like, geez, this stuff doesn't taste good. But geez, look what it's doing for me. Wow, I never felt better. You know, so you just keep on going. And I used to be very proud of my drinking abilities, you know, and I would take on anyone. And often did challenge people to drinking contests, and I never lost one, never did, you know.
I was kind of a lightweight. I've met girls in the program that could outdrink me 2-1, you know, and they'd be like 5 foot tall or something, you know. Like, where do you put it, lady? You know, what's the deal?
Yeah.
So how did rehab go? Now the rehab, it started off well, I take it, and then went downhill from there.
Rehab, you know, again, I brought my attitude with me in a rehab, and a lot of people do, but mine was quite, I don't know if it's my Boston upbringing, I don't know what it was, but it was like, you're not, you know, I'm here. The way I looked at rehab, I was rather naive in a way, because I thought that all you were going there for was to learn how to quit drinking. And in my mind, I imagined private one-on-one counseling, you know, behind closed doors, and just some education, and I didn't know what to expect, but whatever they were offering, it must be good. So I went in with that expectation, and I wanted to learn to be cured of drinking. And I was really shocked to find that a lot of these guys that were there had been through rehab 5, 6, 7 times. You know, then you'd hear things, you know, it works if you work it, and I'm thinking, well, geez, it must be working great for you if you're here for the fifth time, you know. So the first thing they tell you, of course, is alcoholism is an incurable disease. Well, I didn't buy into that theory. I'm like, wait a minute, that doesn't sound right to me. It's incurable disease. You're going to have to get yourself a sponsor. You're going to have to get with the AA program and stay there for the rest of your life. And, you know, at one point, and this is, oh, by the way, all those old drinking buddies of yours, they have to go. You know, we don't want you in a relationship for the first 12 months. If you're in one now, we recommend you don't go back to it. So, I got two little kids at home. And so all these things, you know, it eventually became too much. And I had a really staunch 12-step counselor. He was Georgia. You know, we were in Atlanta, Georgia.
Right.
And he was very, he was a right-wing, no-nonsense kind of guy. He wasn't very popular with anybody in the group. And that was the other thing. It's, oh, my God, we're going to be in a group? I don't want to sit in a group in a circle with about, you know, a bunch of people. I want that one-on-one counseling behind closed doors where it's just me and the person, you know, the counselor. And so I didn't like it, and I didn't want to embrace it. So it took them a week to get me to say anything beyond my name. Did go around a circle, and you know, and some of the guys that had been there before, of course, they're quite open and talkative, and some of them, and of course, it's a staggered thing. You don't all enter into rehab at the same day, so some of these guys have been there for a week or two before you. And I'm like, I just want to listen. I want to hear what you have to say about what we need to do to quit drinking. I'll listen. I promise I'll listen, but I don't want to talk about me. You know, no, let's not go there. And of course, later you realize that the whole point of them talking to you is to break through this wall of denial that you have around yourself, get you to the point where you're willing to at least admit that you've got a problem, and then hand you over to AA. You know, if they can get you to admit that you're powerless, that's a huge step. And nobody wants to think that they are, of course. And we're all there just to learn how to drink normally, like everybody else.
Right.
You know, so, but really, I just wanted to learn how to be able to put it down and not have to have no desire to drink anymore. So I was voted most likely to fail rehab within, I think, the fourth day I was there because I wasn't participating. You know, if I could find somebody else that thought like I did, you know, I'm sure word got back that I had, you know, that I was saying things like, you know, Jesus, what an idiot, you know, and that sort of thing. So, not a happy camper. I paced the front porch of the place. It was on a beautiful setting, you know, with about an acre of grass between there and the street, but I kept looking at that street and wanted to go, you know, and I'm like, you know, they can't keep me here. I signed myself in. I go anytime I want. The problem was there was no place to go to. You know, he said that except back to the same old thing.
Back to
so,
the couch in the cold room, the cold house.
Yeah, you know, and I seriously considered getting a 12-pack of beer if there was a place close enough, gas station or whatever, to buy it, and go in the woods across the street and spend the night there, and then figure out what I was going to do next. You know, but these all things that they sort of held a secret vote, my counselor did with the other group members, and one of the group members walked up to me. He says, "Hey, did you know that that Jim, the counselor, says that you're not going to be here long? He says, he doesn't think you're going to make it." I'm like, "What? Why did he say that?" "Well," he says, "because of your attitude. He's seen guys like you come and go a million times, and you know, and your chances aren't good to make it." Well, that just fired me up all the more. Now I really don't trust you, and I really don't want to talk to you. But I'm going to listen to every word that you have to say. You know, not a single word will be missed, because I'm going to pay close attention to everything you tell us. And eventually, that paid off in the long run quite a bit. But it took him about, I think, probably the sixth or seventh day where he finally got through to me. He tripped me up and got me talking. And I called him Jackhammer Jim, because he was good. He could, you have this concrete wall of denial or protection around your ego, which really, you want to keep him out. And he was having none of it. He was going to get through. And once he got to you, his job was to deflate that ego some, let some of the air out of it. And he did. He did a really good job of it. And it wasn't pleasant, but he did get it done.
I like to think of it this way. Ego will sacrifice the body on the altar of pride in a vain attempt to stay alive. The preacher said, vanity's a vanity. All is vanity.
Yes. Well, we build this wall around our ego to keep the bad guys out. You know, it's because people, maybe it's your father who's treated you, you know, badly and hurt you. So you have these wounds, emotional wounds, and you build this wall to keep people from doing that again. Unfortunately, you become a prisoner of those same walls, you know, and you, as you know.
I've had the similar. A lot of the stories you'll hear, they'll be common threads. I mean, it's new to you because it's that poignant, but I had similar circumstances. I got beat up probably every day that I can in my life. It was either my mother or my father. Every day it was like something. You know, I was incorrigible, and the more I got, the more incorrigible I get. But it has a long lasting effect on your life when things like that happen. There's just no doubt about it. And alcohol and drugs seem the only way to go sometimes. It's the ease and comfort of that first drink, becoming bulletproof, not afraid of women anymore. It's fun. It's fun in the beginning. There's no doubt about it. Until the fun runs out.
That's right. And at 14, I knew exactly why I was doing it. You know, it was rebellion. I wanted to forget about it. I wanted to you know, act like my own person. And you're right. And these are emotional wounds. Everybody carries them to some extent. But you won't see a lot of kids that grow up in a happy household hitting the streets at 14 years old every chance
no.
they get to, you know, to drink or do drugs. These are issues. Addiction is overwhelmingly an issues-driven condition, I would call it. It's an escape. You're running from something. You're trying to kill something. But until you face those issues, one way or another, they're not going away. You know, and it's the same if you're dealing with addiction, or if you're dealing with codependency, or anxiety, or depression. For the most part, there are some cases where there's a biological cause for it, or chemical imbalance, but that's very rare, I think. It's the overwhelming number of people that are taking medications, antidepressants or anxiety medication. It's a band-aid for the real problem. You know, those symptoms are just that, they're symptoms. So when you go for, the three steps of the book are three of AA's 12 steps. It's called Three Steps to Recovery, which is available on Amazon, our website, which is threestepstorecovery.com. When I left rehab, getting back to that, I was asked to leave on the 27th day of a 30-day program, and that's because I hadn't gotten with the program. I was the only one that didn't have a sponsor yet, because I told them, you know, we'd gone to several AA meetings during rehab that were mandatory, but I didn't want any part of them. I had nothing, you know, no problem whatsoever with anybody that chose them, but it wasn't for me. And I think my introverted side was returning, I'm sure of it, and I was self-conscious and shy again, like I used to be when I was 14. Regardless, the whole thing, just whatever it was, it wasn't my style. I didn't want this. I didn't want to be going to meetings for the rest of my life, telling my story. You know, I wanted to move on. I really did. I wanted to get out of it completely. I wanted to put it behind me. We had a priest that would come in every morning, and he would talk about, you know, he'd read the Serenity Prayer or just give us a little bit of a motivational talk in the morning around breakfast time, right after we ate breakfast. And he was an older gentleman, Father Sullivan, and he'd come in and tell us about the spiritual part of overcoming addiction. You know, and I sort of listened to him, and I wasn't religious, of course, but it's like, well, geez, you know, this sounds like a pretty simple solution. And about the third week into it, I asked him, I said, you know, if this what you're saying is true, the, you know, about the spiritual awakening thing that can, you know, relieve you of the urge to drink, why are we spending 6 hours in group therapy every day talking about how we got there? And he just started laughing. He just started laughing. But he couldn't say anything. This was his gig.
No, he doesn't have an answer for that. He does. No.
No, but he gave me one of those all-knowing priest smiles that you see sometimes. And sort of a wink and a nod. And that stuck with me. So my counselor, because I hadn't got the sponsor, you know, by the 27th day, and he warned us, if you don't have a sponsor, you know, you're going home. And I still didn't do it because I just, that wasn't going to be my future. So I was either going to make it or I was going to go back out and do what I was doing before. It was black and white. It was going to be one or the other. All or nothing. And so he did send me home, in the middle of group therapy. He said, well, you think you know everything. You know, you made an example of me for the other guys.
Right, you were the example. I'm not a big guy with rehab. I don't, I hadn't gone to rehab, so usually when it comes to rehab, I keep my mouth shut. You know, and I know some people it's worked for. I had a daughter that went 3 times and it didn't work for her. I've had a lot of friends that have gone many, many times and it didn't work until they actually got the sponsor and worked the steps with AA. That's when it worked. So to me, unless you have to be titrated down so, you know, you don't have a grand mal seizure or a heart attack or a stroke, from too sudden a withdrawal from alcohol, I believe that AA, done properly, can do everything that rehab can do and then some. I believe rehab is really about, hey, I can buy my way, and most of the time my insurance will buy my way into sobriety, and it's the easier, softer way.
That's right. You know, and they're using the 12 steps as their basic program anyways in 90% of rehabs. And they're just going to turn you over to AA. So I agree completely. But, you know, if somebody needs to detox, go into detox for 3 days or 7 days, whatever long it's going to take, and get the physical withdrawal done, and then go straight into meetings. But if you're going to go into meetings, don't just go to the meetings to talk about your problems or whatever. Get somebody that's going to help you with, you know, learn some of those steps, especially the ones that are designed to bring about the spiritual awakening that AA was founded upon. The only reason that AA exists is because of Bill W's and Evie and, you know, their spiritual awakening that they had. That was the point of starting AA. Hey, look, we have the spiritual awakening thing that happened to us. We look and on page 191 of the big book, Bill Wilson says he was cured of his obsession to drink. Cured. That's a word that nobody wants to use anymore because now it's considered an incurable disease. The Medical Association and AA, you know, got together and came up with that conclusion. I think it was a big mistake on AA's part. They did it with the right intentions. If you could label addiction as a disease, then you could get these guys in for the, you know, their health insurance or would pay for their detox.
Yeah, and it starts a whole new industry. We have a new industry now.
Well, that's what happened. They would, you know, at first it was just a disease. So great, now you have insurance company, you know, coverage. You go in and get your detox paid for, and then go to AA. Well, that was the plan, and it's a good plan. Unfortunately, you know, it evolved into this incurable disease mode, and it's become a revolving door thing. And the spiritual awakening message has gone cold. You know, people are not being taught that when they go to AA anymore. It's a support group for people that are forever helpless victims of an incurable disease.
Amen.
That's not the truth. That is the opposite of the truth. AA has done a complete 360-degree turn because of it. And I would imagine Bill Wilson is rolling in his grave. Because that's the whole point of AA was to bring about spiritual awakening that would cure you of the obsession to drink. And it works. So I went home. All I had, you know, when my counselor kicked me out of rehab publicly in front of the group, didn't have big books or anything like that, but we did have a one-page printed copy of the 12 steps. That was it. I had no sponsor. I wasn't going to meetings. I was going to die or I was going to learn how to do it. So through a process of elimination, I must have read the 12 steps 50 times and looked at, you know, at like steps like making amends. I'm like, well, this one obviously comes later. You know, the first thing I need to do is learn how to quit drinking because this is driving me nuts. The urge to drink is stronger than it ever was right now. Even before I went into rehab, this is worse. Now I really want to drink because all I've heard about is relapse and death for the last 30 days, and I got to get this right, and I'm all, you know, and I'm scared. So I take the 12 steps, and I just narrowed them down to the 3 steps that sounded most likely to bring about the spiritual awakening that the priest spoke about.
You had your spiritual awakening before you decided to do that. Tell us about your spiritual awakening, how that...
Spiritual awakening came as a result of those 3 steps.
Okay, yeah, go ahead then. Go ahead, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Okay, so it was, you know, basically admitting your powerlessness, which was an easy one, so I picked that one. Yep, you're powerless over this. believing that a higher power, a God, could and would help you, basically, and then asking for it to be, you know, for your shortcomings to be removed. And my biggest one was the urge to drink. That's all I was concerned with. Let me stop drinking first, then I can work on the rest of me. Let me get this monkey off my back. So I sort of combined those 3 steps. I put a line through all the others and said, first things first, let's lose the urge to drink. I was an agnostic at best, you know, for many years I didn't believe anything like that, you know, there was no such thing as a God, and had nothing to lose anyways by trying, literally, and so I started working, I combined the 3 steps and started using them as prayer every night, in day 2, but especially at night. I was still sleeping on the couch, my wife was in the other room, and, you know, this is where humility and sincerity count, and faith too. You know, if so you just put in blind faith into. As far as I knew, I was talking maybe to God, maybe I was just talking to the wall or the ceiling. Wasn't sure, but I did them for every night, over and over again for about 2.5 weeks. And I was just at the point where I started to think, you know, this is really a waste of time. It doesn't, you know, if there is a God, he certainly doesn't seem to be listening. And it was just as I started to form that thought that I got zapped, and that's the only word I can really use to describe it. It was waves of warmth and a love that I've never felt before. It felt like electricity, too, just entered.
When I was reading the book, you said that there was when it initially happened, there was a fear that went on, like something grabbed you.
It was, right? Well, it's because it was totally so unexpected. I never heard of Bill Wilson's spiritual experience, his awakening, you know, anything, or his white light experience, nothing like that. I didn't know they existed. So it caught me off guard because I thought, okay, well, you know, nothing's really going to happen, but if you do this right, you'll fall asleep tonight, and in the morning when you wake up, you won't want to drink anymore. So it caught me off guard when all of a sudden this energy just started pulsing through my body. So at first it was, you know, you feel like maybe you're having a heart attack or something. You don't know.
So it was a little frightening, and then initially, right? You were just kind of thrown off.
Probably for about the first 30 seconds. It's like, my God, what's going on with my body? Because I'm, you know, because my body's literally flexing and almost lifting you off the couch, you know, with your muscles tense. And you can feel this pull on the top of your head, like your scalp is, you know, being sucked up by a vacuum cleaner or something. And it's, you know, so I didn't know what was going on. But as it went on, that initial shock turned, you could just all of a sudden you felt this warmth coming through with it. And it was very comforting. And that lasted for about 10 minutes or so altogether. And when it ended, I was exhilarated but exhausted at the same time. It was literally you didn't know what hit you, you know. But I was very tired, almost like you're taking a sleeping pill or something. And I was out like a light within a few minutes. And when I woke up the next morning, I said, geez, well, I wonder what happened to me last night. You know, that was pretty weird. And didn't give it a whole lot of thought after that. I just went, you know, I got up and did my thing. And it actually took me several days before the profundity, I guess you'd call it, the profoundness of it set in, of what had happened. But I just realized, you know, two or three days later, hey, I haven't even thought about a drink lately. You know, there is something weird for you right there, because that's all I could think about for the last 20 years, pretty much, especially the last, you know, 6 months. So it was gone. The urge to drink was gone, and that was 19 years ago, and it's never come back. You know, you can try it. And I did try it. I'm like, I think I'll have a, you know, I think this was about 5-6 years ago. I think I'll sit down and have a drink anyway, see what happens. And I did, and it was nothing. It's like, Jesus, what am I doing? I didn't even want it. You know, once it's gone, it's gone. So that's the downside for people, you know. Here's what you got to realize. If you do get the spiritual awakening thing, the party's over. So people need to know that going in. Okay, because when the thrill is gone, it's gone, baby. It's not coming back. You know, so that's the original message. This is what Bill Wilson experienced. It's interesting. You know, I hear some people say, "Well, yeah, but Bill Wilson. I mean, he did LSD and he still smoked cigarettes, and the emphysema killed him." Well, it's very specific when you're doing when your prayer is very specific, and you have this thing called free will. What you ask for and how intent and how sincerely you ask for it, and humbly as well, by the way, makes all the difference in what's going to be answered. You have the free will. You can't just go into use the three steps or the 12 steps or whatever, to go into a prayer mode and say, well, just make me better. It's kind of vague, and it's not going to happen like that. You know, you have to be specific about what you're asking for. And when you do that, then your higher power is able to tune in or zoom in on those particular areas.
I've had experience with this. I call it the prayer of the agnostic. And this is why, because the righteous, it's an evil and adulterous generation that seeks after a sign. So the righteous really are not going to ask for a sign. And then the atheist has nobody to ask.
That's right.
He doesn't acknowledge anybody. So the righteous are not going to ask because they don't want to, you know, they're living on faith. And then the atheist has, so the agnostic has got the edge. So when he asks, is there a God? Because he's questioning now. And if there is a God, let me know. And I'm waiting for the answer. And any time I've interviewed anybody who's had that, who's made that request, it happens, and it always happens.
That's right. You know, and somebody recently debated with me because this person who's never been an addict, very spiritual person, and has a lot of knowledge. I highly respect the person. But they say that you have to use the word God. You can't use the word higher power. You have to, and I'm like, well, all right, then what is God? You know, and hold on. If you, you know, if you're going to deal with somebody who's not already a firm believer in God and may very well have been turned off of religion because, you know, some religions have taught him that God is going to punish him, send him to hell because he's a sinner. How are you going to get this guy, you know, you're going to run most addicts right out the door if I tell them, look, you have to listen to me, just, you know, do it this way. You have to say, hey, God, and, you know, well, you don't necessarily. You just have to say, if there is a God, like, as you say. But the best thing you could do is picture him as your best friend or it, okay, because all it really is divine love. That's the bottom line. That's all there. That's all it is. All suffering comes from a blockage of love to and from you, and all healing and happiness comes from a flow of it, and it's a very real energy. So people often get hung up on words, but the other part of what you're saying, the other part of the equation is, there's nothing quite like hitting bottom really damn hard to make you more willing than you might be otherwise. So I think that you open yourself to it quite a bit more if you've got absolutely nothing left to lose, or at least you feel you do. Then you become more receptive, and you're not going to question so much, you know, what it is, or you know, somebody that hasn't hit bottom, that they're a real hard case to try to
yeah, it's tough. It's tough. My experience is usually they'll go through the motions. That's why I pick up my sponsees the way I do. He's got his chip, and he makes a commitment to me. So yeah. At least I have that beginning of it. I don't chase. You know, there's we avoid what pursues us. So once I give him the simple instruction immediately, and he follows through, I have a good platform of understanding and commitment from him. I know some guys, they know they're supposed to sponsor, so they'll chase this guy, and they'll chase this guy, and he's just not ready. He hasn't hit bottom yet.
You're not going to do anything with anyone that isn't ready, you know?
No.
It's just the way it is. And until the pain vastly outweighs the pleasure of using or drinking, people are going to keep on doing what works for them, you know? The best thing, the biggest advantage you have is to hit bottom really hard, okay? Because then you make a decision, do I want to live, do I want to die? And most people, not all, but most, will say, I want to live. Well, there you go. Now you are willing to do whatever it takes, right? So and you're not going to question the process at all. The three steps, steps one, three, and seven, you can't dance around them. You can't jump to another step. You don't have to wait until you're up to step 12 because by that time you've lost 80% of the newcomers anyways, but, you know, by the time you get to step 4, go get your spiritual awakening first. Okay, get that done first. The byproducts, the benefits of all the other steps, the principles behind them will manifest themselves naturally. You will make amends. You may not do it on paper with everyone you meet, but amends really means change more than it does apology. You'll make amends naturally. You will change the way that you deal with people, okay, or people from your past and in the future. Eventually, you're going to, these are, you know, acceptance and tolerance and all these things. After you've been zapped with a spiritual awakening, these things are going to start coming natural to you. These are the qualities or the emotions that start to replace all the negative ones that you carried for so long. It's like a complete, it's like your higher powers come in, yanked all the bad stuff out and filled you up with this good stuff. Right. So these things, and then you carry the message, that, and that's what the book was about. I wanted to, I wrote a book for people that are struggling alone, that are not, you won't find them in meetings, or they're not in rehab or whatever, but they're desperately wanting to quit, and they may just be too shy. I know a lot more people that avoid AA meetings have gone and run out the door than I know that have stayed. Nothing wrong with AA at all. You know, really, I'm all for it, and I don't trash AA in my book. In fact, I do quite the opposite. I just tell them in the book how it was for me, how I felt about it. So the book is not for people that have found their recovery. It's about people that want to learn how to really beat the addiction for good and become cured of it. And I don't know how many times people have attacked me for saying, you're going to kill somebody with that information. There's no cure for addiction. And it's so frustrating because most of those people are some of the biggest AA advocates out there, and they haven't heard the original message. It's time to get back to the original message.
And yeah, back to the basics.
The rehabs aren't going to tell you. The doctors aren't going to tell you. Okay, you're a big cash cow to them. Okay, and you're going to come back and back and back and back and around and around. Go through it. The thing about this spiritual awakening is there's certain elements that have to be applied. You have to be humble. You have to use humility. It doesn't mean you have to grovel or cower in fear of your higher power. He is your best friend. He's here to look after you. You know, so if you can explain these terms to people, and it does that in the book pretty well. Sincerely, humbly, faith. You know, even if it's a half faith, it's still faith. You know, even if you're not 100% sure, you're still putting your faith into it that it'll work, more so than hope. And these are all important elements. The scary side of it is you have to walk through your fears. You have to gather the courage to do that from within yourself. As a sponsor, you can take the people that you help, Joseph. You can take them to the door, you know, to get a spiritual awakening, but they still have to go inside alone while you wait outside the door for them. You know, nobody can do it for you. So that's a scary thing, because you're facing your own self in the mirror and the things you really don't like about yourself, and you also present it to this, you know, eye in the sky, whatever, you know, a great spirit, whatever you want to call it, and asking for help, and you're giving up your own control because you're asking for your will to be replaced with his will for you. People don't like that. It's scary for people. Wait a minute, but I've always been in control, just like I was for so many years.
On the website, you know, I agree with you. I could see why you ran into conflict with, you know, taking some of the steps away. The purists would have a real hard time with that. I would tell you this. The letter of the law bringeth death, and the spirit of the law giveth life. This is about the spirit. This is about getting, and this is what I believe in Rum Radio too. On the website, I didn't do it, Michael M. from Chicago, taking somebody through all 12 steps in 24 hours just using the big book. My deal is 30 to 45 days, Joe McHugh, but the key is the fifth step. Getting the sponsee through the spiritual experience as quickly and thoroughly as possible. I will sacrifice thorough for timely. I think the timely is much more important. Once they get the spiritual experience, there's a lot better chance that they will attain and maintain long-term sobriety. Now, if you can get them passionate in carrying the message, that's the seal of approval. There's no guarantee, folks, but this is my experience.
Well, that's right. That's it. And in the original AA, I was reading where they used to take them through it in about 2 weeks' time to get them to their spiritual awakening as soon as possible. In order to become a sponsor, you had to have had the spiritual awakening yourself before you could sponsor others. That makes perfect sense to me. You know, wait a minute. Here's the guy that's done it and got it. He's the guy that's qualified to teach somebody else how to do the same. You know, he's not the guy that screams it works if you work it every day for 25 years. Okay, that's not the guy.
I say in meetings, and it quiets them down a lot when I say that. You know, they don't like me because I know the shtick, you know. So they don't. Yeah. I use the big book, and they have no argument with that. So I would tell them in the 12 and 12, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone, and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of true kinship between God and man. So not only is it asking us to speak a fifth step, to hear a fifth step. Who hears a fifth step? A sponsor hears a fifth step. And until you hear a fifth step, you're just circling the field, waiting to run out of spiritual gasoline, and then it's another crash and burn. They don't like that.
No, well, that's because the truth isn't popular. Okay? And that is the God's honest truth right there. Unless you're willing to release that power, that power you think you have, the same power that got you into your mess, you're not going anywhere, okay? Because I'm telling you, when this thing, you know, as you know yourself because you've been through it, when you've been zapped by your higher power, everything changes, okay? There, you know, relapse is not an option. As I said, you can try to relapse, but it's not going to work. You know, there's no going back. You can never go back. And you can't fail. You'll still, you know, you're not going to wake up the next morning and go skipping down the street in your underwear throwing rose petals over your shoulder because life is that good now. You're still going to deal with problems in life. You're still going to have bad days and good days. The way you react to them is going to change entirely. You know, you're not going to run for the bottle every time somebody sneezes or looks at you the wrong way. You don't need to do that anymore. You have this. There's a peace and a quiet strength, and that is your higher power's will that's entered into you, and that stays. You don't feel the need to shout about it or anything like that. I didn't tell anybody about mine for years, and I didn't give it a whole lot of thought myself. It wasn't until I knew that the spiritual awakening that saved me could save other people. And it has. And there's people, you know, there's a gentleman in Australia, hardcore drinker and drug user, doing meth and drinking constantly. And I have a group on Facebook called Three Steps to Spiritual Healing and brought him into the group. He was actually the son of a friend that I met when I was living in Australia years ago. And he told me, he says, my son's got a really serious problem. He's living at home with us. He's 37 years old. He's divorced. He's drunk all the time. I don't know what we're going to do with him. My wife won't put him out on the street. He's been to rehab. He didn't last. He came home. And all he does now is sit around here drinking. He's tyrannizing the house. He's terrorizing everyone. And he came into the group, and last thing he wanted to hear was the word God. He said, you use the word God and I'm out of here. So I didn't go quite that route. I don't anyways. I like the term higher power because anybody from any background can sort of relate to it, or at least accept the possibility that it exists. Right.
Dan, we have 2 minutes, so if you have any things that you want to get out in the last 2 minutes about the book or how to find you want to reiterate that for the audience? Or
sure. Okay. The book is called 3 Steps to Recovery. It's available through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, basically any bookstore in America or Canada or Germany or UK can order it for you. You just go to the website, 3stepstorecovery.com, click on the Buy the Book tab, and it will show you all the places you can buy it. If you just want the PDF version, it's available right there. Kindle or paperback is available. The price is affordable. I've got another book that we're getting ready to release soon. This one's interesting. It's based on a spirit medium's conversations done through automatic writing with 7 souls on the other side. They explain the purpose of life, and they explain what the afterlife is like, how they live over there, and